It's a little bit noisy here at Empire State South.
That's okay.
But in front of me is David Wondrich, who is the author of many books on spirits and cocktails and bartending, and really responsible as the, you don't know this, but we hold you as the brain trust of all things liquor.
That's a little terrifying.
But yeah, it's okay. It's okay. You got to keep that brain
trust
intact.
I mean, that brain's pickled in a jar somewhere.
Well, yeah, but yeah. Yeah, but that's fine.
Yeah.
It's booze.
That's the job.
It's a preservative as well.
Yeah,
so it's
true.
Good. So, David, I've got Imbibe in front of me, which is a book you wrote in, what, 2007?
It came out in 2007, and then I rewrote it about 4 years ago.
Yeah, I've got the rewritten version, which amazing to me is to talk about how much things have changed in restaurants, but also when it comes to cocktails and cocktail production and bartending, it's changed exponentially in the last 12 years since you initially wrote it.
Oh, I spent so much time in the first edition on ingredients you can't get.
Right.
You know?
And then suddenly they were available.
Suddenly they partly because of the book and also because of the work a lot of other people were doing, suddenly, yeah, you could get everything. And so I had to rewrite that whole part, you know.
I read that in the new introduction.
Yeah.
So what were some of the ingredients that were impossible to find before that are now on the scene?
Well, we couldn't even get like a real old school Jamaica rum, you know, like a pure pot still funky pirate juice Jamaica rum you couldn't get true peach brandy, like distilled from peaches. Now you still kind of can't get it. It's made by a lot of small distillers, and they all make about one barrel a year.
Where's peach brandy usually produced?
It was originally produced down here in Georgia.
Yeah, because I think...
That's why they had all those goddamn peaches.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't for eating, because they kept for about 3 days.
Yeah.
It was mostly for distilling. Huh. They made a lot of peach brandy down here.
So who's making it in Georgia now?
Now, I'm not sure. I don't know of anybody off the top of my head. People are making it in places like Colorado, California, Massachusetts.
Now we are in Georgia, but I will give a high five to Colorado on their peaches, because
yeah,
their peaches are fucking amazing.
They are. They're really
good. They're amazing.
They're really good. And their peach brandy is really good. They've got a couple of the best brands.
Yeah.
I know that people still make spirits from peaches here in Georgia, but I don't think they're making it commercially, if you know what I mean.
No, it's kind of more least, backyard wine.
Yeah.
It's the Scupperdonks and Muscadine affiliations are there, and they're distilling.
And you might get a glass jar with some white stuff in it that
right.
Was made from peaches.
But even the quality of moonshine, I find, has gone up exponentially as we've learned more about it. They're just no longer dirty. They're different. The place, oddly enough, the place where I probably have consumed the most moonshine is arguably the most expensive hotel in North America, which is Blackberry Farm. But that's where we all consume.
Yeah, I haven't gotten any moonshine in a long time because a lot of the moonshiners have gone legit, I guess.
Yeah, they have. It's easier to be legit these days.
Yeah, and now they're micro distillers.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a different connotation.
Yeah.
Not as much running from the police.
No.
But, yeah, I mean, all that prohibition gave us NASCAR in some weird way.
Yeah,
through that.
It gave us all kinds of, it gave us the mob.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know, which,
I don't know.
I probably
there's
no thank
things,
you, but on the
but...
other hand, it gave us a lot of entertainment.
So you've had many, many jobs throughout the years, apart from being a writer, but you were a professor of Shakespeare for a while?
Yeah, I was an English professor.
Okay.
That was the worst job I ever had. It was terrible.
My sister's an English professor and teaches a lot of Shakespeare in Canada. But,
Well, teaching the Shakespeare was great. I liked that part. I didn't like the academic politics. I didn't like the workload. I didn't like the conferences I would go to were always in a motel on the highway with a cash bar. And everybody was mean.
You know? The conferences have probably gotten better in the
Maybe.
Last 10 years.
Yeah,
but
I don't know. You know, now the conferences I go to, they fly me business and I get free cocktails.
You got to go to Tales of the Cocktail each year and things like that.
It's full of sporty people who are fun and exciting and not out to steal each other's jobs.
Not curmudgeonly untenured professors.
Yeah, exactly.
But you've had many other jobs, too. How'd you fall into writing about and having the jobs you do now about liquor, wine, and beer?
Hold on. This
hold
this
on. We're
going to
get
drink,
a cocktail.
And we've got a drink. So.
We've got a drink coming your way.
Kelly Thorne, our beverage director for all the restaurants, is bringing us a beverage of sorts. It's got beautiful ice in it and some sort of greenery. Is that a fern? That's not a fern.
It's a pineapple leaf.
It's a pineapple leaf.
Sign for welcome. So welcome.
Thank you.
This is a silk curtain. This is aged rum agricole, the Clément Select Barrel. A little Bonal aperitif wine, a little pineapple liqueur from Jaffard, and a Dissoni Amaro liqueur to add some berries.
How lovely.
Enjoy, gentlemen.
Thank you. Cheers.
Chin chin.
That's
good.
Oh, I needed that.
Yeah, it's 4 o'clock.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
So I got into this job like kind of through the back door, as everybody does. I was starting my professor job, and I was already not liking it. And I was writing about music on the side for the Village Voice.
You were a jazz critic.
I was a jazz
critic.
That's
right. There. I'm a huge jazz fan.
Oh, good
so
for you.
We'll definitely
God
talk
bless
about
you.
That.
You know, there aren't enough jazz fans left.
And I go to this crazy jazz record store in Toronto, Canada, called Cosmo Records.
I've never been. I gotta go.
That's the place that like I go by there and buy a bunch of Archie Shepp records there.
Yeah,
people like that, and they're just the most insane jazz collector store.
I mean, when I was writing about this stuff, I did more early jazz because the Village Voice already had a jazz critic who did that kind of thing, and he was very famous and very good. But he hated like swing music and Dixieland. And I actually liked that stuff because I came out of the rock world.
Yeah.
And that stuff was like small band, kind of rowdy, you know. And I was like, okay, I can understand
this. You can appreciate that.
And so I started writing about that and discovering that you could catch that stuff live every night in New York with all these bands who were phenomenally good. And I wrote about them. And one day a friend of mine called me up the end of 1999 and he said, Dave, I know you write about music, and I know you got a couple old cocktail books and like cocktails, sort of. Do you think you could write about them? And I said, nah, I'm really busy. I don't think so. And he said, well, you know, it's for Esquire magazine's website. And I'm like, well, that sounds like fun, and I like Esquire.
That was 1999? Yeah. Was there a website? There was a website.
He was the director of Allhurst New Media, my friend Josh Mack. They only had one guy, basically, and just a couple people. But Esquire did have a website. And I still was like, nah, I don't know. And it says, we'll pay you $3,000. I'm like, what?
I'll do it.
I was a junior professor with a 2-year-old at home. You know, that was a lot of money for me. So,
but you'd never really bartended or anything?
No, nothing like that. I'd worked in bars for years because I was a musician, so I played in bars.
Yep.
So I knew, you know, kind of how bars worked, and I spent a lot of time in them, but I'd never been a bartender. I knew how to mix drinks some. I'd made some effort on that. But
so what was the Esquire article online?
Well, they had an old cocktail book that they wanted to put online, and I organized it and rewrote. I noticed that some of the drinks had these kind of sporty little paragraphs about them, about some of the recipes, and I started writing those as headers for the different categories. And Esquire, my editor at the time, Brendan Vaughn, says to me, you know, we like those things you wrote. Can you do one of those a week? And I was like, okay, you know, you'll pay me. Yes, we'll pay you. And so suddenly I was a drinks columnist.
Back in the day when you got paid to write stuff.
I know, and I started at the top, basically. You know, I didn't have any, I didn't have to struggle with that part of the business at all.
So from that, you crafted it out, you got a book deal somewhere along the line.
Well, yeah,
and Imbibe was the first book, right?
No, I wrote Esquire Drinks first.
Okay, yes.
And because they hadn't done a drink book in 20 years, and David Granger, their editor, who was just an amazing guy, said, yeah, sure. The minute I walked in, he said, yes, let's do that. And so I did that. Then I wrote a book about music. Then I wrote a little flip open cocktail book because they paid me cash on the barrel head and I was poor. And then I wrote Imbibe. And Imbibe was like the book I really wanted to write. It was a biography of Jerry Thomas, the first, as I thought then, the first famous American bartender. Turned out there were others before him, but he was the first one to write a book.
So Jerry Thomas was a bartender where?
Where do I start? New Haven, Connecticut, New York City,
And this is like 19...
Oh, no, it's 18...
It's 1800s.
Yeah, 18... around 1846, 47 in New Haven when he's 16 working for his brother. And then he becomes a sailor. Then he jumps ship in San Francisco in 1849, tends bar out there after some other stuff, goes back, opens a bar in New York under P.T. Barnum's museum, which is kind of amazing, and then goes broke. Plus, he had like $16,000 in gold when he got back to New York, and he spent it all in 3 months. And that was a lot of money back then. I mean,
$16,000 in gold.
Yeah, the fanciest hotel in town cost you a dollar a night.
Wow.
So,
what did he blow it on?
Gambling, I suspect.
Okay.
Sports book.
Yeah. Yeah, you can waste a lot of money that way pretty quickly. So, Jerry Thomas is really known as like one of the first documented people who were making quality driven drinks. But all the drinks in that time were kind of liquor forward. They weren't really concoctions. They're more like slight hints of something.
Oh no, there's some good mixing. The one thing they don't use is what a lot of drinks use today is vermouth.
Okay.
You know, where you soften the liquor.
Yeah.
They soften it. There are a lot of sours. There are fixes, which is like a sour with a fancy garnish. There's the sour, there are punches by the glass. So those all use a lot of mixing. There's milk punch. The cocktail itself though is very booze forward.
Right.
It's just hints of bitters, hints of liqueur, a liqueur, usually orange curacao, and ice and sugar. You know, it's really there's.
Do
not
they
much
have
to
really
it.
Crazy ice programs back then? Like we all
well,
have to
they
have
they all
now?
Had blocks of ice and they carved them up.
I guess
yeah, they butchered them to order. So
it's like the progress we've made in bartending is going back to the days of yore.
In some ways, it's at least enabling us to do that stuff, you know? We can still do modern stuff. We'll still have a blender. But there's stuff that they had that, for a long time, was beyond the skill of any bar here. When you couldn't get rye whiskey, you couldn't make, like, a good, you know, a good Manhattan. You couldn't make a proper one, anyway. When you couldn't get blocks of ice, you couldn't vary the size of your ice for the effect you wanted. So you couldn't have a big chunk in a drink that was a slow sipper, you know?
Right.
You just had to fill it up with the crap chips that came out of the Japanese machine.
Mixology by necessity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when did bartending change in your mind in the last, like, what's the biggest change in the last 20 years? In food, I think it's like, it's the enablement of enabling chefs to get better and better ingredients, a focus on those ingredients again, but also sort of making sure that not just four stars was where technique and professionalism and thought and like core fundamental values of food came into play. Is that the same kind of...
Well, we're a little behind on that last part. The other parts... You know, a lot of bartenders came out of the culinary world. There's a lot of the inspiration came from seeing what happened with chefs who went from being cooks, a job that was not much respected, to being a job that you can actually make a good career at and, you know, build a life for yourself and a really satisfying one, you know, if you're lucky, et cetera. And bartenders kind of went through that. I think that was the biggest change, was the desire to be a better bartender.
Right.
You know, and the realization that if you were a better bartender, like one who was historically informed, who knew what all the ingredients were, who knew all the, you know, who really knew the business as a professional, that you could actually have a career. And it started earlier with, you know, I'm friends of Larry Forjone, who, because my wife used to work for him, and Jonathan Waxman also. She worked for both of them in New York in the 80s. And, you know, those guys were such pioneers. But they had already figured that out in the 80s. It took bartenders until to create the conditions for that until about 2005. But now we've got the conditions for that.
Yeah, I mean,
have somebody like Kelly, who's a fantastic bartender, but also was like beverage director.
Right.
You know, who has a career.
Right. And I think that was a sort of sitting down of a lot of people within our profession going, hey, wait a minute, this is not just a last ditch effort type of profession. This is one where I can actually excel, because most people invest minimal effort into doing it. It's that type of job for the majority of people.
Yeah, for a
but
lot
if
of people,
you want
certainly.
To invest a lot of smarts into it, it can be like it's this endless topic that suddenly
and
arises.
It's a very rewarding job. It's a very hard job, like line cook or short order cook. You know, it's
so it's physically taxing and
physically
hours
also
along.
Also mentally taxing in that you have to, you know, every time somebody orders a round of drinks, you have to systems engineer it and do it in front of them while talking to them.
Right.
So that's kind of crazy. That's where it differs even from the kitchen. You know, it's the kitchen, you've got to do all that systems engineering.
You bet you don't have to play therapist to the guy three seats in at the bar.
And you don't have to do personnel management to the same degree. You see the same people every day.
Yeah.
You know, they see different people and they've got to size them up.
Yeah.
It's a very hard job when done well. I mean, it takes a lot of intelligence.
So Americans were unwilling to pay more than $8 for a drink up until probably about 15 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that we were able to sell it as a better experience, a better quality driven ingredients, et cetera, and having the customer realize that they're making an investment in the skill set that's there.
Yeah.
Right?
I think they see where the money goes.
Okay.
You know, if you go to a top bar, I mean, I've seen modern craft cocktail bars open in the craziest places. I have my family has a property in extremely rural Pennsylvania, across the Delaware River from New York State in the northeast corner of Pennsylvania. I mean, farm country like you wouldn't believe. There's nothing there. Right across the river in an old firehouse in a town of maybe 200 people that had no commercial spaces whatsoever. These two guys from New York, originally they were from various places in the country, but they opened a craft cocktail bar, and it's hugely popular. It survived. They opened it last summer. It survived the winter with locals, and it's, you know, all the summer people go there. I mean, whoever's up there, not that many, but the locals go there too and realize that, you know, they used to be paying $5 for a cocktail, and there they're paying $8, and it's worth it. It's very hard to go back. You know,
is hard to go back.
You get a really good drink, and and then you go, that thing was crap.
What do you think the first step to realizing what skill sets on the palate do you want the average American to have to understand what a good drink should taste like?
Well,
like let's talk through a classic old fashioned.
Yeah, I think
what differentiates
it from
being great.
I think they already got it. You know,
I think they do too.
I think it's because.
But I think that was a monumental change for me, is when I realized when an old fashioned was not hitting the notes I wanted it to hit. It was usually because it was saccharine sweet,
and
lesser quality ingredients, and you could tell that. And then the ice was not great, and
it was watery, you know, and watery and sweet. But I think, like I said, you give people the proper one, and they seem to go right with it.
They won't go back.
Maybe like the first time it's a bit of a shock, but they come back, and it's pretty stunning. I mean, I think people have America and Canada too, frankly, in the U.S. and Canada, people have this palate somewhere in the back of their brain. You know,
do you find European cocktail culture outside of the U.K.? The U.K.'s got pretty strong cocktail culture, but it's funny that. And this is not navel-gazing. I'm Canadian, so I'm not navel-gazing at the United States as an American, but I'm dual now. But it's funny when I go, say, for coffee. I go to Italy, the hotbed of what people think is historically great for coffee, and there's not much good coffee.
Well, it depends. It depends. You know, I like espressos, and I get a lot of good espressos. Anything else there, you know, that's not their thing.
It's not their thing.
No, they're espresso drinkers.
But it's funny that in the States and in Canada, I think we've come so far on so many fronts, culinarily drink-wise, that we excel at really great coffee shops. We excel at really great cocktail emporiums and bars and things like that. And I'm just wondering, like...
Well, I'm half Italian, right? And I've got Italian citizenship as well. So so I spent a lot of time over there and kind of have a little more of an inside look at the culture over there. And I think, you know, Italy has a strange but actually pretty good cocktail culture. France, less so. In Italy, it's they don't go out to drink. They drink like during the day.
Right.
Whenever. You know, it's not a big deal.
Just wine always.
No, but they'll get an aperitivo.
Yeah.
There are a lot of pastry places and candy stores that have fully stocked bars. You know, that's just crazy to us.
See, it's when like, I was a kid going to the candy store, that's what I always dreamed of.
Yeah. You got like, you can get a martini. There's an 1830 candy store. I mean, it's that old in Torino, and you know, in Turin, that is like the oldest candy maker, and like also sells ice cream, etc. But it also has this small little stand up bar that fits about 8 people. But it's fully stocked. They've got mezcal. They've got sherries. They've got like 8 different kinds of funky rum, you know? And they make those too. They make coffee. They make ice, you know, whatever you want. And that's kind of like the Italian model. It's have a drink in the middle of the afternoon, or it's 11 o'clock in the morning. But they're not going to have 6, you know?
Yeah.
They'll have 1.
Yeah, but we still go out and have 4 or 6.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the difference.
It's in traveling the world, I find I can stumble onto some places and find and eke some things out through a little bit of searching and find the most interesting bars these days. Like I went to one in Lisbon, Portugal.
Uh-huh.
It was literally the size. It was like 12 feet deep and maybe 4 feet wide.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And
I love
it was
that.
Tiny. It was run by this obscure American eccentric guy. Uh-huh. And he had the best little bar, and it was great.
That's
the
fantastic.
Cocktails were awesome. But when you
I'm
find
have to
those
get the
things,
name
it's
from
like,
you because
yeah, I'll look it up
for when I go to Lisbon.
It was amazing, and it was just cool to see cocktail culture going on there. But but it's kind of everywhere now. I think we just respect it. I mean, I grew up making my grandfather was a soldier and an engineer and in Canada, and he was born in India and all this crazy stuff. He's a British guy, went through the mailroom and became not for money and became the CEO of his company, whatever. But he'd make himself old fashions every night, but with like CC, like Canadian Club, the worst old fashioned
Canadian
ever.
Club. Well, you know, went downhill considerably in the 20th century.
Yeah, I think it lost its luster somewhat. Yeah. It used to be a real rye.
Yeah, yeah, well, it did.
I mean, Canadian whiskey's coming back.
You know,
it is. But are there really good ones?
Yeah, there are. Well, what they're doing is, you know, they always made good whiskey, but it was like they took a pound of Kobe beef and blended it with 9 pounds of just, you know, supermarket beef.
And you end up with supermarket beef.
Exactly. And now they're saying, you know, if we keep even a half pound of that Kobe out of there, it's not going to change that at all.
Right.
And this stuff is delicious.
Yeah.
So they're starting to do special bottlings, and there's some really wonderful whiskeys. A couple of years ago, the best whiskey I tasted that whole year was a pure corn whiskey. Column distilled, the very light, aged for 10 years in very old barrels. It was just the subtlest, like smoothest, most delightful whiskey.
Yeah, there are a bunch
imagine.
Of distilleries and smaller ones in like Collingwood and places like
Collingwood.
That now. Yeah.
Yeah, which is
interesting culture coming up
yeah.
there. Yeah,
it's kind of the weird up there.
The luxury ski area for Toronto.
The dive bar is carpeted and has fluorescent lighting. For an American, that's just really weird.
It is. That's kind of like the... I spent some time in Alaska one time in Juneau. And Sean Brock and I dared ourselves to go into the bar that everybody said, do not go in there.
Oh, yeah.
And
you had to.
It was the worst bar ever.
Oh, yeah.
It was just that Listerine over urine over throw-up smell.
Yeah, that's not so rough.
That's not good. So what bartenders... I'll tell you the bartender I like, and not just because of their... ability with a shaker and their ability to make a good drink, but just because I think they're one of the best humans in the world, was Jim Meehan.
Oh, Jim Meehan's an old friend of mine, a lovely guy.
And so
there are a number of really wonderful bartenders that I know. I know, oh God, so many.
You know a lot of bartenders.
Now, here in Atlanta, you know, Greg Best.
Greg Best and Miles McCary.
Yeah, they're old friends of mine. And
yeah.
Paul Calvert and... you know, these the Eric Simpkins.
Ticonderoga
Kelly, of course,
and then you know, Watchmen are like side by side.
Yeah.
And it's amazing the skill sets and the cocktail resumes of those two places side by side, separated by a door, is pretty amazing.
That's pretty amazing.
For Atlanta. So you don't really find that many places.
I mean, but, you know, around the country, there's so many great bartenders. I mean, it's... endlessly surprising. I'm a judge at Speed Rack, which is the women's speed and accuracy bartending competition. I could not imagine competing in that thing. I would break down. I would be in tears. I mean, and these women are just so fast and so tough and so accurate. It's amazing, you know. And they're going out and tending bar. I mean,
yeah.
It's a really interesting time for this weird craft.
It's a really good time for the craft, just because I think it's more respected than ever. Yeah. It is funny how it's changed, though. You know, Kelly runs the bar program here, obviously, but. I mean, there's a full prep list now.
Oh,
it used to be the bartenders should show up at 5, fill the ice bin, and get going.
Yeah, they'd cut limes with the same knife, the only knife.
The really dull one.
Yeah, that you used to open boxes. You know?
Yeah.
It was like,
yeah.
And now they
have their own knife rolls, and they're willing to spend, making shrubs and special garnishes and tonics.
It does eventually pay off. Not for everybody, but it can pay off.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can get a good career.
Yeah,
and because you know how to do all that stuff.
But you can also branch out and write about it and research, you know, their websites. I know you write for Punch a fair bit, and people like that are just a great assets to the community, and that they give it a professional foundation to build
on. Absolutely. I mean, now you can do a career as a drink writer. When I started, there were very few people doing that. And, you know, when I focused on history, nobody was doing that. It was just this weird job that I basically invented using my academic background and my like for corny jokes and
it's a good creation
colorful
you
language.
Created.
So,
yeah.
You know, there you go.
What are you working on now?
Now, God help me, I'm the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Companion to Spirits and Cocktails.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's like a decades-long project, isn't it?
It's a really long project. I'm nearing the end. Thank God, because it's a nightmare. But I've learned so much.
Gastronomique of libations.
Basically, is the idea, you know, with like figuring out histories of things, actual histories, not like what the companies tell you.
Right.
You know, all that kind of stuff is just.
Not the narrative that their social media companies have created for them?
No, apparently not. You know, those apparently a lot of those that leave something to be desired. I was shocked.
Yeah, booze history is crazy, but endless.
No, there are very few, you know.
How many pages is that book going to be?
Oh, it's going to be big. It's going to be big. We've got 1,200 entries. Yeah,
wow.
So,
who's publishing that?
Oxford University.
Okay, Oxford, yeah.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
I've got their wine book.
Yeah, it's in that series.
Yeah.
So, hopefully it'll come out good.
Yeah.
I'm terrified.
What's the best drink you had in the last week, other than the one hopefully you're consuming?
Okay. Last week I was up in the country and I was making this crazy drink that I came across. It's called the Jeunesse, youth in French. And it's a French drink from the 1940s. It's two parts Cointreau, one part lemon juice, and one part Suze, which is a gentian aperitif.
Yeah.
It sounds like it would be way too sweet. The main spirit is a liqueur. But it's freaking delicious, and it's not too sweet. It's just crazy.
The Cointreau is not too sweet. The lemon juice cuts it enough.
Yeah, yeah, and the bitterness from the Suze also.
And what's Suze?
Suze is a yellow 20% alcohol gentian aperitif from France.
It is French, okay.
Yeah, and this was a French drink, and but
did it
I'll
look like bright
it
yellow?
Delicious. It's pretty yellow.
It's like looks like a piss test.
Suze does.
Yeah, Suze is bright yellow.
Yeah, and the drink because the lemon juice
muddles it out
a little bit. Less urinary.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, which is good. Exactly.
But it on ice?
Yeah, shaken and strained.
Okay.
So like a cocktail, like served up.
Huh.
It's fantastic.
That's cool.
I recommend it highly. It's it makes no sense in any form whatsoever. That's why I had to try
it. But so many drinks don't really make sense
There's enough. I mean, there are a lot of really good drinks that just follow the formulas. But some of these, every once in a while, there's something like that that just somehow somebody hit on something.
Now, in my world of food, I'm always like, I don't want young chefs to suddenly be wanting to make Grand Ackett's food, right?
No.
I want them to learn how to roast a chicken first. I want them to learn how to tend for
God bless
vegetables
you.
And properly poach asparagus and, you know, do and make really great stocks that have a clarity. Well,
that's how you can run a good restaurant like Empire State South here, you know, where
but
you've got like the fundamentals down.
But it's really difficult to keep them from wanting to make lobster air suspended in a gelée of jasmine. But do you find
that's the same with bartenders.
It's the same with bartenders.
These days, yeah. It's a rare one. I mean, the ones I like the best are the ones who focus their energy on learning all the dirty jokes, you know, and have an easy rapport with their customers.
Because a good drink is one thing, but an arsenal of dirty jokes people feel comfortable and cared for is another.
And also, you know, it's conversation. It's amusing. And a bartender who can tell a lot of jokes is a really good thing, as long as they can make the drinks, you know. I mean, to some degree, they don't have to be the most creative. I mean, they have to be to know the standards.
What's your favorite hotel bar?
Oh boy!
Bigger classic hotel bar.
Yeah, classic hotel
anywhere.
Bar. I'm trying to think. I mean, there are a lot these days. I would say the Nomad Bar in New York.
The Nomad
but that's
Bar
not a classic.
Great.
That's a new one. It's pretty great.
It's new, but it feels very classic.
I like,
they design around patina well.
Yeah, I like the bar at the Georges Sank in Paris, but
yeah,
you know, just because.
But I mean, people should go to these places regardless of if they're staying there or not.
Thank you.
Kelly's back with another cocktail. We're lubricating ourselves into the 5 o'clock hour very soon.
This is the Stolen Muse. This is VSOP Cognac, La Quintanaille Blanc Vermouth, little Pierre Frangin Curaçao, which I think you might know a thing or two about.
I do.
And some Luxardo Bitter Bianco.
Oh, lovely.
Enjoy.
This
Beautiful.
Is right up my alley. Thank you.
So,
well, cheers.
Explain the Curaçao.
The Curaçao...
What is Curaçao?
Curaçao is a blanket. It's a blanket term for orange liqueur, basically.
Okay.
And people didn't
understand. So is Cointreau a Curaçao?
Yeah. Triple Sec is a style of Curaçao. Grand Marnier is a Curaçao. They both used to be marketed as Curaçao until they decided that they were, you know, grand liqueurs and only to be known by their brand name. That was their marketing idea. But this Ferrand Orange Curaçao came about because Alexander Gabriel, the head of Ferrand, is a friend of mine. And I was down at his facility in Cognac. And we were tasting cognacs to come up with a new blend. And he asked me, what do you think of my orange liqueur? And I said, I wish it was more like a traditional Curaçao. He goes, oh, I can make that. And I knew how to do it because I'd been playing around with a little pot still I had at home and made a fairly good facsimile of 19th century Curaçao. So I knew what I was looking for.
Okay, so you're making this Curaçao. Walk me through the annotated version of from start to finish. How do you make a Curaçao?
Well, okay, you distill orange peels with, in this case, grape alcohol, like fairly neutral spirit. Add some other spices, and then
what spices like cardamom,
peppercorn,
that type of thing.
These are a secret.
It's a secret.
I don't even know. I mean...
It's such a secret.
No,
David doesn't even know.
There's not much, you know?
Right.
It's just hints of, of like, accompanying
I'm getting, like,
spice.
Nutmeg and clove, but in very fine amounts.
I mean, that could also be coming from the vermouth.
Yeah.
Which is highly spicy here. But then you finish it with an infusion of fresh peels. Like the traditional way is
just to macerate
distill it once
and
with
flavor?
Peels, and then you take the peels that you've distilled, and you put them and you steam any remaining alcohol out of them, and then you combine those, blend those together, and then to make it a triple Curaçao, you would take fresh peels and infuse them in brandy, and this is what how Grand Marnier was originally made, then you mix that infusion in with the original, with the other part. So you've got three different liquids based on orange peel that you're blending together, and then you sweeten it. So it was.
And is there a clarifying aspect to it?
You clarified for sure. You let everything settle.
Okay.
For the last infusion.
But no fining. Or just settle?
The last one probably needs some filtering and fining. But originally it was done with neutral spirit and orange peel. But in 1893, the Café Royal in London went to the Marnier Curaçao Company in Paris and said, instead of using the neutral spirit for that final infusion, can you use some of the old cognac from our cellars?
Oh.
And they said, yeah, we could try that.
Money's no object.
And then,
let's do this.
Paillard, the restaurant, saw this and said, hey, can you do it with our cognac? They said, sure. And then Paillard went and had it made in Holland instead for cheaper. And there were all kinds of lawsuits.
Yeah.
And it ended up with Grand Marnier.
Wow. That's
they
crazy.
Didn't even know this until recently.
History. We're always discovering
it. That's always fun. That's the fun part for me.
So I think that sometimes in food and in beverage, you know, Kelly and Steve and I, Steve, the wine director here, I often have to check ourselves to remind ourselves that though we love this stuff and we know a lot about it, what we think is going to fly and be popular, we're looking through a pretty small prism because a lot of America still wants just a good, simple drink, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, what do you think the next thing America is going to cling on to as being, like, just part of their regular repertoire?
I'm coming around to kind of to America's point of view at this point. After doing this for 20 years, I'm like, I don't really want it to be that complicated, you know?
Yeah.
I'm back to drinking martinis.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, I don't think so.
It's kind of like in the world of food, you find these great restaurants that you want to go to.
Yeah.
You go to them, and you've read all the hubbub, and you eat it, and you're like, that was really good. I would probably go back in, like, 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, I like...
Yeah, I want something I want to go back to every week.
I go these days more than once a year, at least, to Relative and East. You know that? This is a restaurant there from Paris. They've got a couple branches in New York. They serve one menu. You get a salad with a nice mustard vinaigrette. And then you get steak,
an entrecote,
grilled as you wish, and fries, and that's it.
You know? But what do they do well? All of it.
All of it.
It's very
delicious.
Limited, and it's all delicious.
You know, I come around to execution is just so important.
But that's the thing. I mean, if you walked into a restaurant and went to the bar and said, and they have a menu with three things, that's great.
Yeah.
As long as they're all nailing it.
Exactly. But that's the trade-off is like, okay, we're going to keep it simple, but we're going to do it really well. I mean, you know, that's like Italian food is very good at that. It's like, our menu is the same menu you get all over town, except the dish is different wherever you try it, but not like greatly different. It's not reimagined. It's just the details of execution. It's like, this guy uses a lot of onion. The over here, she doesn't use much onion. She uses maybe a little nutmeg, you know, and but it's all within the parameters.
But they get the best Parmesan Reggiano and use it copiously, and that's why it's good. And their
the
technique
ingredients
with
are
this.
Impeccable.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's the key. But it's also a focus on a limited idea that you want to perfect that limited idea. Like, I always look at fast food and I think, why does everybody love In-N-Out? It's like In-N-Out does basically, it's a really tiny menu.
Yeah.
Whereas you look at McDonald's menu now and they've been throwing shit at the wall, hoping something will stick
for
like 20 years.
Well, I mean, it was all over once they introduced chicken nuggets, you know, really. I mean, because then they weren't a burger place.
No.
You know, it's
chickens don't have fingers.
Yeah,
or
even the filet of fish. It's like...
Or the McRib.
Yeah, I mean...
And that's even just seasonal.
Yeah, but I remember McDonald's from a kid. Their burgers were great. You know, at least I thought so.
And I wasn't allowed to go... No, I don't think I liked McDonald's as a kid. I don't know why. I was a picky kid.
You know, I was... I was born in 61, and this is like the mid-60s, when McDonald's was like over 3 million sold.
Yeah.
You know?
I was born in 71. I think they're still claiming to something good at that point in time.
Yeah, I think they were still... That was, you know, the 70s saw them transform. In the 60s, it was still a burger chain.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got things in paper and, like... And they had the big golden arches and all that. And they focused on burgers, and so they did it fairly well.
They did a good job.
Yeah, they did a good job. Yeah. I mean, it's important to... you can be creative, but I think it's, you always got to have in the back of your mind, with, especially, you know, with drinks, probably with food too, is like
a little restraint goes a long way.
Yeah, you're always, it's always a balance, and whatever you move it on one spectrum, you lose it on another.
Yeah, it's like the New York Times published a salad the other day from Via Carota, Jody Adams restaurant. And it was so simple and so brilliant and so good. And it got me thinking, like, then I come in here and I love my chefs. I love my people. But it's, sometimes it's just so busy. Why are you adding all these things to it? It's like that salad doesn't need, you know, curdled buttermilk on the base that's been smoked. It's like it just.
One or the other,
just take it away. Give me a great vinaigrette with really beautiful butter lettuce and some shaved radish.
We've got sources here, you know. Now we've got sources.
So if somebody wants to learn more about cocktails at home, what's a book that's approachable for the masses that'll steer them in the right direction?
Meehan's manual is very good.
Jim Meehan's manual.
You know what's a really good one is Paul Clark's Cocktail Chronicles.
Okay.
Because that has sort of a home emphasis, and Paul's very knowledgeable, and it's a lovely book, a little underappreciated. You know, that's a great place to start. If you want the history part, I would say, you know, My Imbibe is a good place. If you're really a history geek, I wrote a book about punch, which is all about the British Navy and all kinds of stuff like that. And that one's really geeky, but kind of fun.
But that's the world we're in. We're in a geeky world.
We are.
It's a good geeky world.
Yeah.
That's why we have better coffee and stuff.
Yeah, I mean.
Because somebody geeked out on that shit.
And then you go, you know, geek out on it, and then bring it to the people.
Yeah. But you got to figure out a way that's palatable and, transportable to the people.
Yeah, while still being great. But, you know, we're smart people. We can figure it out.
So what. What is something that's going to come on the horizon soon? Like vermouth is having its day.
Yeah, I've been trying to avoid this question.
I know. Well, it's like people ask me. It's like, what's your favorite thing to cook? And I'm always like, fuck, I don't know. That's good.
I've seen like people have said pisco is going to be big.
They were saying that 10 years ago.
People have said cachaça is going to be big. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened either. And those are two wonderful spirits from here in the Americas that I love dearly. Rum, I think we're going to see. Some sort of connoisseurship about rum that's going to be very disappointing to people who really love rum, because you're not going to be able to get the good bottles anymore. I think that's right now what's happening.
Yeah, really good rum is really small production. Yeah. And rum is very distinctive throughout the Caribbean where it's produced.
Yeah. I mean, we're arguing right now. There's a huge argument about like how to label it, how to regulate it. And hopefully we'll come out of it where you get some sense of what's in the bottle, which is held
Does rum agricole really mean anything?
Yeah, it does, actually.
So what does it mean?
That's made in the French Caribbean from sugarcane juice with, like, certain, you know, restrictions on what kind of juice is used, et cetera, et cetera. So that's okay. It's just regular rum. When it just says rum, it can be a variety of different sources, different distillation techniques, all blended together. And sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's just crap. And that's what we're up against.
Yeah, really, some dark rums can give you a headache. I mean, that's blackstrap molasses of beverages.
Dark
in a lot
rum
of
is, you know, what makes it dark, it does not have to be age.
Right.
It could just be, it's just be more caramel.
Yeah.
A golden rum, white rum with caramel, you know.
I took a tour of a rum distillery in Hawaii.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they're doing single varietals of sugarcane and producing like 20 different rums from different varietals.
Yeah, see, that's
really interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, there are going to be differences in flavor.
Yeah.
They're going to be a little subtle. But
well, that's the other thing. There's like 300 different types of sugarcane out there. So,
But there's all kinds of ways of fermenting and different distillation and all that stuff. And, you know, now there's the move is that I think this is my prediction for the future. We'll see more stuff identified very narrowly as to how it was made, you know, so you can actually read the label. And that stuff is going to be hotly collected.
Well, traceability and everything.
Yeah, I mean,
we like that in wine. We like it in cheese. We like it in coffee now. Elevations, stuff. Plots, all that
so
stuff.
So the stuff with the most information is going to do the best.
Is going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The most transparency. And, you know, like you said, we see this in a lot of stuff.
Do you like Havana Club rum still?
I do. I don't like their 7-year-old very much.
12-year-old's good.
I like their 3-year-old.
Can you buy it in the States now?
No, I always got to bring it in from abroad.
Yeah, they have it in Canada.
But
everywhere.
it makes a great daiquiri, I think. You know, it's still the daiquiri rum.
Have you been in Havana?
I have.
It's interesting.
Interesting. I was there in 2011.
I find the drink culture there is actually relatively good. There's some real amazing stalwarts
also,
of quality.
The music is great in all the
great.
Bars.
The food is the horrid.
Sometimes, yes. I had some good food, and I had some really bad food.
Yeah. We've been... unfortunately, squeezing them more and more because they keep meddling in Venezuela. But
yeah,
I think yeah,
I know
it's a confusing world out there.
I know it's. I mean, it's a shame. I went to one or two paladars that were very good.
Yeah,
and then one or two paladars that were mediocre, and a bunch of state restaurants that were deeply mediocre.
Oh, the state restaurants.
But you know, I'm used to. I grew up in. I lived most of my adult life in Dominican neighborhoods, rather.
Right.
So, you know, I'm used to the general cuisine.
The paladars of
Brooklyn. I'm used to a lot of heavy rice and beans and, you know, basically food from the west of Spain with Caribbean ingredients. So yep. it's not light.
No, it's not. It's got some rich overtones to it.
Yeah.
Well, this book is amazing. And you won a James Beard for it, which
I did.
Is awesome. What was the category on the James Beard?
It was a drinks book. This is the first cocktail book to win a James Beard Award.
Well, you broke the
I broke the seal.
Broke the seal. Broke the ceiling. David Wunderich, great to have you on. And it's a delight just to talk about all things booze.
Well,
because it's
ever-changing. A great pleasure. Get to have a couple drinks and talk.
Yeah.
This is wonderful. Thank you.
It's awesome. Thank you.